Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. I've been told that today we're reading chapter 1, verse number 11. Does that sound right? Okay. And this chapter is called Observing the Armies. There's another title to this chapter, but I'll talk about that later. You all have books, most of you, one way or another. We can chant together. Ayane shuccha sarveshu. Ayane shuccha sarveshu.
Ayane shuccha sarveshu.
Yata bhagam avastita. Yatha bhagam avasthita. Bhishmam eva virikshantu. Bhishmam eva virikshantu. Bhavanta sarva eva hi. Bhavanta sarva eva hi. Ayaneshu cha sarveshu. Yatha bhagam avastita. Bhishmam eva virakshantu. Bhavanta sarva eva hi. Okay. Ayaneshu. In the strategic points. Cha. Also. Sarveshu. Everywhere. Yatha bhagam. As differently arranged. Avastita. Situated. Bhishmam. Unto Grandfather Bhishma. Eva. Certainly. Abhirakshantu. Should give support. Bhavanta. You. Sarve. All respectively. Evahi. Certainly. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, all of you must now give full support to Grandfather Bhishma as you stand at your respective strategic points of entrance into the phalanx of the army. Who is speaking here? Yes. Purport. Duryodhana, after praising the prowess of Bhishma, further considered that others might think that they had been considered less important. So in his usual diplomatic way, he tried to adjust the situation in the above words. He emphasized that Bhishmadeva was undoubtedly the greatest hero, but he was an old man, so everyone must especially think of his protection from all sides. He might become engaged in the fight, and the enemy might take advantage of his full engagement on one side. Therefore, it was important that other heroes not leave their strategic positions and allow the enemy to break the phalanx. Duryodhana clearly felt that the victory of the Kurus depended on the presence of Bhishmadeva. He was confident of the full support of Bhishma Deva and Dronacharya in the battle, because he well knew that they did not even speak a word when Arjuna's wife Draupadi, in her helpless condition, had appealed to them for justice while she was being forced to appear naked in the presence of all the great generals in the assembly. Although he knew that the two generals had some sort of affection for the Pandavas, he hoped that these generals would now completely give it up, as they had done during the gambling performances. Ooh. Such are the calculations of the demons. Ayaneshu chasarveshu yata bhagam avastitaha bhishmam eva abirakshantu bhavanta sarva eva hi. All of you must now give full support to Grandfather Bhishma as you stand at your respective strategic points of entrance into the phalanx of the army. Whenever I meet someone who has just acquired Bhagavad Gita for the first time, I feel I need to warn them that the first chapter is a bit of a challenge. If one has no clue of the context of the Mahabharata, one encounters, first of all, so many strange names, difficult names for anyone not familiar with the tradition. So many names, and then what is being described, some kind of battle, and there's this side and there's that side, and who's on which side and why, and what does this have to do with spirituality? This doubt may be there. So I like to kind of warn them and say, you know, try to be patient, go through the first chapter, even don't worry about the first chapter, start with chapter 2 and go back eventually to chapter 1. So if you like to come in, there's a lot of space still. There are chairs also if you prefer to have a chair. You're okay. All right. Getting ourselves settled. Yes, chairs. Pure plastic chairs. But they work and they function. This is one blessing of the petroleum industry. Yeah, practically. Okay, so we're talking about the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, which is, it's really kind of setting the scene for the drama. And indeed, one helpful way, I think, of considering the Bhagavad Gita in general is as a kind of drama. And drama comes in many different forms. There's, of course, comedy, there's tragedy, there's tragicomedy, there's melodrama. So just how we might classify the Bhagavad Gita or the greater drama, the Mahabharata, is an interesting question. But in general, we can say it's a drama. One of the kind of essential elements to make a drama is there has to be some conflict. And certainly we have a conflict here. We have a very distinct and definite conflict. We have the beginnings of a conflict, you could say. And it's in the form of what's going to be a war, a very as violent as a war can be, you could say, is being prepared. And what we're getting is the preliminaries of this war scene in an interesting way, because we're getting lists of names. Usually when we think of armies, we just think of sort of nameless masses of soldiers, especially in modern warfare. You don't think so much of names. And, okay, there will be generals, but modern-day warfare, the generals are generally not out on the battlefield in the front as they would have been here. So this is one interesting feature of what's happening here. Another interesting feature I find is that it's lesser known, but if you go back a few chapters, 6, 7 chapters, something like that, in the Mahabharata, This first chapter is, I think it's chapter 25 of the Bhishma Parvan, which is the 6th of the 18 Parvans. And so the beginning of the battle is happening. But there's something rather strange that happens around chapter 13, at least in some versions, and we have to sort of qualify this because someone can very easily ask, well, which version of the Mahabharata are you speaking about? There are so many versions, so many recensions, Northern recension, Bombay recension, Calcutta recension, anyway. But, okay, let's say whichever recension Ganguly translated. You have in chapter 13, it seems kind of out of the blue, but Sanjaya, after he's been talking about totally different subjects with Dhritarashtra, all of a sudden he says, Dhritarashtra, I have to announce that Bhishma has just been slain. What? Wait a minute. The war didn't even start yet. What is going on? So it seems like the structure of narration, at least in this section of the Mahabharata, there's a kind of intentional turning upside down of sequence. And at least one, you could say, function, if you like, of hearing this, that Bhishma has been slain, is that now we, when we come to this first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and we hear about Duryodhana being very concerned to protect Bhishma, and incidentally, he's very concerned, not just here, but in an earlier chapter, he's also coaching his armies at that time. You really have to protect Bhishma. We really need him. If we don't have Bhishma, hard to say what will happen. We need to have Bhishma protected. There is a danger, and he mentions Shikhandi. You know, Shikhandi is a big danger. So he's very concerned. Anyway, we read all of this, and we go, hey, he's already dead. Well, he's not dead, but he was fallen. And so there seems to be like a preview. Sometimes if you watch a movie, they'll give a preview of what's to come, just to get you excited to watch the whole film. So that seems to be what's happening here. And this makes for a kind of irony, because as we read, it's like we know more than Duryodhana does. As we read Duryodhana saying these things, it's like we know more than he does. But let's look a little at Duryodhana's mentality, because this is much of what Srila Prabhupada focuses on in his purport. And the verse is speaking about positions. Ayaneshu cha sarveshu yatabhag amavasita. Be situated in your, Prabhupada translates it, strategic points, positions. So he's being like a good military strategist. He's planning for the battle. And all of this, of course, is going on an open field. So it's very different from, you know, so much of modern warfare, which can happen in so many different ways. It's one thing it's not is guerrilla warfare. We always learned when I was growing up in America, it was all about, you know, the glories of the American Revolution and how we beat the British. And it was actually kind of guerrilla warfare on certain occasions. And one problem the British had, seemed not very bright in this regard. Their uniforms had bright red coats. They were called the Red Coats. And they had bright red coats, sort of like, here I am, shoot me down, you know. We say also in English, like sitting ducks. But here on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, everything is out in the open on what apparently is just one big, huge field. So there's not, there's not complicated terrain. In any case, Duryodhana is thinking in terms of some sort of manipulation, some sort of organization, some sort of planning for his own benefit, for his own, obviously, for his own victory. Now, again, there's a bit of an irony here, I think, because let's think about Bhishma, his life. What is characteristic of Bhishma?
Bhishma had no wife.
He had no wife? Yeah.
Did he?
No, he didn't have a wife. Why did he not have a wife?
He made a vow.
Not only that he would not marry, that he would not have children. And when the devas heard this, what did they exclaim? Bhishma! They were shocked. How could anyone make such a vow? And so, yes, this was the beginning of his career, if you like, as what turned out to be the leader in many respects of both sides of the Pandavas and the Kauravas. He became known as the grandfather. And he was, it can be said, it has been said by some commentators, that Bhishma is an example of the nishkama karma practice which Krishna is talking about in later chapters of the Gita. He is an example of that. Why? Because he's taking care of so many people, and none of it's really for himself. He's taking care of his stepbrothers. Let's see, first there was Vichitravirya and Chitrangada, both of whom died early. And then later he refuses because Satyavati, his stepmother, wants him to sire children. He says, no, I've made a vow. And so Satyavati calls in her son, who we have to say technically is an illegitimate son. Who is this? Vyasa. The Vyasa, whom we all revere, technically he was an illegitimate son. He's called in to sire these children, Pandu, Dhritarashtra, Pandu, and then Vidura, by not the widows of Vichitravirya and Chitrangada, but rather by a maid servant, because Amba and Ambika, Ambalika, they just couldn't stand to have anything to do with this Vyasa. So the point is that Bhishma took care of these sons. He acted as a kind of father or uncle. He was doing so much for them. And none of this was, you could say, for his own benefit. And so he can be seen as a kind of example of nishkama karma. Now, if we think about Bhishma further, it comes to some interesting questions. And here, I'm not being original about this. I find a quite interesting book, a kind of study of some of the aspects of the Mahabharata. It's called The Difficulty of Being Good. Anyone heard of this book?
Yeah, I heard.
Yeah, it's quite easily available now. I think it's in the airport bookstores even.
By Indian author?
Yeah, it's an Indian author, Gur Charan Das. So he's, in his book, he's kind of reflecting on his own life, and he's thinking about morals and ethics, and he's reflecting on different situations, and he's talking about Bhishma in one chapter, and he says, let's look at Bhishma and see, is it the case that because he's practicing nishkama karma, he's perfectly virtuous? And this can be indeed questioned. Why the issue comes up that Prabhupada mentions in the purport here, that he was silent at the time that Draupadi was being attempted to be disrobed. And when he's questioned by Draupadi about this, what does he say? He waffles. He says, it is very difficult to know what is dharma, what is not dharma. He won't commit himself. Gur Charan Das kind of takes this a step further into modern times to make the point that just doing one's duty does not make one automatically virtuous. And the famous example he gives is the Nazis, who were exterminating the Jews. So, and he mentions Adolf Eichmann, who escaped to Argentina and then several years later was captured by the Israelis, and they brought him back to Israel and they put him on trial. Adolf Eichmann was considered the architect of the Holocaust. So they put him on trial on something like 15 counts of criminal activity. And yeah, his defense was, he said, yes, it was horrible. And Heinrich Himmler also told soldiers, I'm giving you a duty which is really very terrible, but it's your duty. And this was the defense that they were giving in general in the Nuremberg trials in Germany also. I was simply doing my duty. And the conclusion of the court in both cases was, that's no excuse. So Eichmann was hung. And the point being that just being nishkam karma does not make one virtuous. And if we study the Bhagavad Gita, I think this becomes confirmed, because Krishna is not, he doesn't stop with nishkamya karma. He says this is the first step, in effect. So, point I wanted to make is this interesting contrast between Duryodhana and Bhishma in their mentality. But we cannot say that it's simply a case of the good guys and the bad guys. For one thing, Bhishma is on the same side as Duryodhana. Why is he there? That explanation is given, that he was taking the salt. In other words, he was eating in the house of Dhritarashtra, Duryodhana, and therefore he was allowed himself to be dependent on them, therefore his position was compromised. But the bigger issue with Bhishma that comes through in various ways, subtle ways, is that just because Bhishma made this great vow does not really make him perfect. But then we get, in effect, a commentary to the Mahabharata. We call it Srimad Bhagavatam. And as you know, in Canto 1, Chapter 9, we have a summary, a very, very reduced summary of Bhishma Dev's last words, his instructions, which of course in the Mahabharata are very extensive. The Moksha Parvam? Very extensive instructions he gives to Yudhishthira, and then having given those instructions, what does he do? He offers prayers to Krishna. Krishna is present, personally present, and the whole point the Bhagavatam is making is whatever Bhishma did or did not do, he is a devotee, a pure devotee of the Lord, and therefore this is what matters. That's all that matters. Well, that may well be the case, but here, at this point in time in the Bhagavad Gita, he is just a very powerful soldier, hero, who must be protected. Now, all of these arrangements and all of these names of soldiers and generals and so on that we're getting in the first part of chapter 1, as I said, it's setting the scene. And we could say that what we're getting with all of this is the external picture, which is preparing us for the internal picture, which is going to emerge. It's going to begin to emerge in the latter part of this chapter. Of course, Arjuna is going to, I like to say, he's going to have a kind of emotional breakdown. Although he has, previous to the Bhagavad Gita, again some chapters earlier, he has reassured Yudhishthir that we will win this war. And prior to this, I think it's prior, he offers prayers to Durga, and he gets blessings of Durga that you will be successful. But now, what's going to happen? We all know what's going to happen. When he's face to face, when it gets personal, when he sees the faces of Bhishma, of Drona, of the other generals and soldiers, and he sees that he knows these people since childhood, he has this breakdown. How can I face them? How can I release arrows with the intention of killing them, and so on? And so he has this very disturbed state of mind, which may explain another title of the first chapter. Traditionally, each of the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita have a title which is not given in the beginning of the chapter, but at the very end of each chapter. And each of the 18 chapters are included in the title is the word yoga. And so the first chapter is traditionally called Arjuna Vishada Yoga. What does Vishada mean? Yeah, it can mean despair, despondency. So the yoga of the despondency of Arjuna. What kind of yoga is that? How is that yoga? Well, one way to understand that it's yoga is that as we read about Arjuna's despondency, what do we feel? We may feel some, not despondency, but we may feel some sympathy for him. He presents a considerable list of what strike us as very good reasons to not fight. It's almost like a study in what could be called consequentialist ethics. In modern Western ethics, ethical philosophy, there are different categories. There's what is called deontological ethics, fancy word for duty, where the question of, the sort of key question of ethics is, what should I do? It all kind of boils down. What should I do in this circumstance, in that circumstance, in life? What should I do? The answer of the deontologist is, do your duty. Okay. But what's my duty? Well, in the case of Arjuna, Krishna wants to make it very clear what is his duty. Your duty is to fight. Why? Because he's a Kshatriya. He has a certain disposition which is very appropriate for that purpose. Well, then there's... So duty, the idea of this kind of ethics is, if I just do my duty, I don't have to worry about about anything. I just do my duty, and everything will be all right. Well, as I said in the example of the Nazis, this comes into question. Well, then there are the consequentialist arguments that say, well, we've got to look at what are the consequences. But then there comes another question: how do we know what will be the consequence? Consequence means in the future. Well, you can say, well, from previous experience, from whatever kinds of evidence. But still, that's in the past. How do you know for sure that what you think is going to be will be? So then there are problems there. There's a third kind of major category of Western ethics, and that's virtue ethics. The idea is basically you don't have to worry about anything except cultivating virtue. And if you become virtuous by preference, by nature, by inclination, you will do the right thing because you are virtuous. Well, as we study Bhagavad Gita, this can be an interesting exercise, is to see where one or another of these sorts of ethics is emphasized, because you'll find all three of them in various places and various degrees. But at the end, or in the latter part of the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, we have Arjuna giving a brilliant performance of consequentialist ethics. He's saying, I'm not going to do this because look at what all the consequences will be. It's going to be a total breakdown of society. The women will not be protected, and so on and so forth. And what's Krishna going to say? He's going to say, Pandit, I'm very impressed, he says. But you're a fool. But, okay, that's not the whole story, because throughout the Gita, Krishna also talks about virtues, one of which is ahimsa. I think the word comes up four times in the Gita. So it's a little complicated, but here's the bigger point I want to make, is we have this sort of external picture in which externalities are important. For Duryodhana, it's all about appearances, and it's all about power. And so he's concerned about position, and he's concerned about all of his people acting according to his wish, and so he sees the world in that way, and he's showing that kind of world. When we get to Arjuna with his breakdown, in a sense you can say it's a breakdown of that worldview. He's really questioning that whole worldview. But then you may say, isn't Krishna then coming right back and saying, no, this is the worldview we're going to go with. It's power against power. That's what we have to do. Well, you could say that on one level, but on a deeper level, there's something else going on. And what is that? What is Krishna saying to Arjuna in the beginning of the fourth chapter of the Gita about his relationship to Arjuna? What does he say? Many births. What else? Yes. Many, many lifetimes, but what's the relationship? Yes. I'm speaking this to you. Why? Because you are my friend and you are my devotee. That is the core. That's the inner Bhagavad Gita. That relationship between Krishna and Arjuna. And that is why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu praised the South Indian Brahmin. The South Indian Brahmin who couldn't read, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recognized him as understanding the Gita. Why? Because this man was crying, and when he asked him why he's crying, he said he was just thinking how amazing and wonderful it is that that Krishna is taking this humble position of being the chariot driver of Arjuna out of friendship. So just feeling how kind Krishna is to Arjuna. Then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, well, you have understood the purport of Bhagavad Gita. So that's the internal. And then externally, yes, there is this war going on. It's about to happen. But it's already over, and that's going to be, we're going to be reminded that it's already over. Remember, Bhishma has, in effect, already been killed. We got this preview. And then we're going to get another preview in chapter 11 when Arjuna, shaking and shivering in front of this universal form of Krishna, which is devouring everything, which is the opposite of the universal form that he showed Duryodhana, in which everything emanated from him. Now he's like a cosmic vacuum cleaner and he's chewing up everything. Arjuna's shaking and shivering, and he says, "Who are you?" And what does Krishna say? "Time I am. Kalosmi lokakshaya krit pravidho. Lokam samahartumiha pravidha. Time I am, destroyer of the worlds, and I have already taken care of this whole situation. These armies are going to be finished." So we get another, you know, advanced, preview, exactly. So that's all going on the outside, but what's going on the inside is this relationship between Krishna and Arjuna. And what is the relationship? It's one of sakya, it's one of bhakti. And that, of course, is what Krishna unfolds in the course of his teaching as well. It's all about bhakti. Manmana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru. Ayaneshu chasarveshu yata bhagam avastitaha bhishmam eva virakshantu bhavanta sarva eva hi. All of you must now give full support to Grandfather Bhishma as you stand at your respective strategic points of entrance into the phalanx of the army. Comments? Questions? Yes. In the case of Bhishma, we might say it's a matter of I spoke of consequence. It's a matter of circumstance, and we could say the lesson is that people find themselves in all sorts of difficult circumstances, which they may not have complete control of. Who has control over their circumstances? There are so many things we find ourselves involved in one way or another. And not least, we find ourselves in a world full of politics. I like to quote some scholars of religion. They say religion and politics are two sides of the same coin. And we certainly see that in Bhagavad Gita. So, by the complicated interstices, the complicated web of action and reaction, which takes place on countless levels, a person finds him or herself in a particular situation. And within that situation, they need to make decisions as best they can. So Bhishma is such a person. He's a jivatma who, by all these different circumstances, there were curses and blessings and the Mahabharata. In general, is very much about the ambiguity of Dharma. The Mahabharata, it's understood, is occurring at the end of Dvapara Yuga. And by this time, the clear distinctions of what is Dharma, what is not Dharma, have become quite blurred. And they become very blurred in the battle of Kurukshetra, so much so that even Krishna is telling Arjuna to do things which are clearly opposed to the Dharma of a Kshatriya on the battlefield, and so on. And there's so much discussion about that. So the ambiguities, the lack of clarity of what is Dharma, the whole Mahabharata is like a study of that. And then you get this sort of interlude, in a sense, which is the Bhagavad Gita, in which also Dharma Kshetra Kurukshetra. The issue is still Dharma. And the conclusion, of course, is that Krishna says, give up all this about Dharma and just surrender to me. Having given up, the sarva dharman parityajya, that parityajya is the gerund form, which means having given up or giving it up, surrender to me. It's to be done. It has to be already happening, and then you can surrender to Krishna. The Bhagavad Gita is sort of opening up this cloudiness, which is the whole Mahabharata. What is Dharma? What is not Dharma? So many things. Bhishma is going to say in the Moksha Parva and that whole section about what is Dharma, Varna Dharma, Ashrama Dharma, but still, what is Dharma? Sarva Dharma Parityaja. And then Srimad Bhagavatam, Savai Pungsang Paro Dharma, Yato Bhaktira Hokshaje. And it's after that the prayers of Bhishma are told. Are quoted, Bhishma's prayers to Krishna. So in effect, you can say the prayers at the end of Bhishma's life to Krishna are in themselves, that's a kind of final purification, you may say. Yes, he's been a devotee since early on or throughout his life. And yes, there have been, questionable behavior on his part. And so now, finally, as he's leaving his body, by his own choice, Krishna is present. Everything becomes put in its right, in its proper place. So it's not a static thing. Somebody is a now somebody has a rubber stamp, pure devotee. That's it. And Krishna will say also in the ninth chapter, Api chet suduracharo bhajate mamananyavak sarureva samantavya. If someone even does something really bad, suduracharo, sadureva sa mantavya, that person is to be regarded as sadhu if that person is taking shelter of the Lord. Is that?
One more point. Hmm. Just like Arjuna is giving so many arguments to Krishna. And just like we see that Lord says everybody has a free will. So his free will was not to fight. Then Lord is interfering him and giving so many arguments that you should fight.
Yeah.
So independently, when we are here, we don't have anyone to guide us. So we, our free will.
Yeah.
So how can we act on our free will, whether we are doing right or wrong?
That's a whole discussion, isn't it? That's always something we all struggle with, I would say. I'm myself included. Narottam Das Thakur's song, Sadhu Shastra Guru Vakya, Hridaye Khoriya Aikya, Satatam Bhajibo Prema Maje, he says, may the words of sadhus, plural, guru and shastra, may they all become aikya. Aikya comes from the word eka. Eka means one. So aikya, you could say, means a singularity, a single clear understanding. So Sadhana Shastra Guru Vakya. Chitte te, in my consciousness, my heart, or Hridaye, Koriya Aikya, may they become this Aikya, this clear understanding in my heart. Satatam Bhajibo Prema Maje, then I will always float in Krishna Prema. So that's what we're aiming for. But it's the challenge which we each bear to take the responsibility to hear Sadhu Shastra Guru and to reflect, so Shravanam, Mananam, and then what's the next, the third? Nididhyasanam. Nididhyasana means something like digestion. It's like you put something in your mouth, you chew, you swallow, but then you have to digest it. So the digestion process is service. We engage in service. That engaging in service is what is the digestion. And as we digest, we serve, then we get again eager for more nourishment. We want to hear more. And all of this is an ongoing process. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam.
Talking to Arjun that he has to do his duty. So out of this in your lecture and other in the book, you can see that Krishna didn't, that Arjuna didn't know what was his duty. And then Krishna told him he had to fight. My question, do we in general know what our duty is? Do we know what to do, apart, separate from the consequences, positive or negative?
Mm.
Do we know in practical life, daily situation, everybody, individually, know what is our duty?
Mm. Well, it's I would say it's a lifetime project, and our duties can change over time. The different factors in our lives will change as we get older, as we have different responsibilities. If someone is a younger person, you know, we can think in terms of the varnas and ashramas in a general sense. They kind of map out, especially the ashramas, in terms of our individual lives. They help to orient us. But again, it's when I say sadhu, it means, it can mean friends, it can mean devotees who we respect as senior. It can mean god uncles. You know, it is a god uncle or a god aunt. You have your guru and you have the god brothers and god sisters of your guru. They may also help to give guidance sometimes. And then I think it's in a sense the same question. We want to make, you know, the clear, we hope to digest all of this, to have a clear sense of what we are to do. In general, it's extremely simple. What do we do? We follow four regular principles. We chant Hare Krishna. We associate with devotees. These are our duties, very clearly defined. And then is the question, okay, how do I adjust, how do I shape my life? Prabhupada said, mold, how do we mold our lives around these principles? That will be very individual, depending on so many factors. And we have to use our own intelligence for that.
Still, within your individuality.
Yeah.
Do I know what is my duty? I know you cannot generalize it. Everybody has an individual personal duty.
Hmm.
So
I don't know if you know what is your duty.
Am I supposed to know that?
Well, we want to know, isn't it? We want to have a sense of what is our duty. Another way of putting this, I do a bit of study of other religious traditions. That's part of my academic work, and in particular Christianity. And they have this notion of calling, that you have a calling, a sense that God calls you to do a certain thing. I find that very, very nice, actually, to feel, yes, this is my calling. This is what I have been put here to do. You know, that can be very nice. One has to be a little careful, though. If you start, you know, pushing the world out of the way, this is my calling, you know, that can be taken the wrong way. Yes, Manish.
Mentioned about calling, and then we have our, you know, nature sort of dispositions. So is there a difference between the calling and the natural inclinations?
Oh, I don't know if we can. It might be a matter of seeing how different sort of terminologies might come together. If we go back to the Gita, we do have the notion of swadharma, one's own dharma, and some time ago I was quite struck by the thought, which I don't think it's been very explicitly put in our tradition, but it can mean absolutely unique dharma, because sva is your own. We can, more generally, it's used in the case of the Gita. Krishna is saying, this is your dharma, svadharma, to be a kshatriya. But there are many kshatriyas. There are so many kshatriyas. So there's different, sort of layers of duty. And to identify what is my own, the modern, you can say, New Age idea is all that matters is how I feel. It's kind of I, me, and mine all over again. It's sort of the original selfie philosophy. A few weeks ago, I was in Mayapur. I was walking toward where I stay, and a group of a family, I guess, or two families of local pilgrims were there, and they spotted me, and they came rushing toward me, and they surrounded me with their mobile phone, smiling. They wanted to take a photo with, this white-faced guy, And they said, "Selfish? Selfish?" I said, "Yes, selfish." So, but the notion of duty in the context of dharma, the word dharma comes from the verbal root dhr, dhr, D-H-R with a dot under it, dhr, that's the verbal root, the dhatu. And the meaning of that is essentially to sustain. That which sustains is dharma. And the sustaining is sustaining within a society. No one is isolated. And so dharma, very broadly speaking, is about learning how to give, because conditioned souls, we all have a problem. We want to take. We don't want to give. So dharma helps us to learn to give. Okay, I think we can stop there. Thank you all very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Bhagavad Gita as it is ki jai, Anantagoti Vaishnavarinda ki jai, Gaur Premanande, Hare Krishna.